Hey, welcome to Our Altered World. If you've been feeling overwhelmed by the giant that is climate change, you're not alone. I'm Neil, and here we celebrate the inspiring work of individuals and organizations making real positive strides that you may not have heard about. My hope is for our conversations here to make you feel inspired and reconnected to our planet. And with that being said, I would love to introduce Sam from the MRN, McCaw Recovery Network.
Hi, it's fantastic to be here. I'm excited to chat about McCaws today.
Thank you for being here, Sam. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and the McCaw Recovery Network? How did you first become interested in McCaw conservation and what brought you to work for the MRN?
Yeah, so I've been involved with parrots all my life, and growing up as a kid, a friend of the family had some birds and I was just fascinated. This was in North England, so it's far removed from where parrots call home. And it's just been a lifelong fascination for me that I can't really explain. I just have been captivated by parrots, and then that led me to conservation. I read about conservation work in the field, which was just like my dream come true, and managed to get to do field work when I was 16 years old. And then from there, it wasn't like a planned trajectory. I've just kind of bumbled along and found myself in conservation and founded a nonprofit in the Caribbean. And then I came to Costa Rica I was involved with McCaw Conservation, but saw there was a need for a bigger picture view on conservation. And so from that, a group of us developed the McCaw Recovery Network. And we just see there's a great need and great potential with McCaw conservation.
So you've always kind of had that connection with wildlife and various species throughout your livelihood, like growing up and within this sector. When you first came into the conservation sphere, how did you find that experience in terms of like having that sort of fulfillment from your attachment to, like, let's say your birds as a child, to then actually going out and doing conservation in the wild and actually starting to protect species? How was that connection for you?
Yeah, it was really interesting looking back, because there was one particular book called by Douglas Adams, who also wrote Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. He traveled around the world with a zoologist, Mark Cowardine, and wrote the book Last Chance to See. This was redone more recently with Stephen Fry. And that really opened my eyes to the idea that parrots existed in the wild. I didn't really thought about it before then. And then, I got to go to Mauritius and work with this critically endangered bird. There was only 12 in the world at that time. And it was just all the things I loved brought together, like running up and down mountains, climbing trees, chasing after parrots, watching what they're doing. And so I just felt at home with another group of conservationists that was just so passionate and dedicated. Growing up in North England, I was a bit of an oddball, but this was like I was at home, and it was just amazing.
Being surrounded by people with similar passions, doing exactly what you want to do. No, I love the sound of that. You kind of already touched upon why the MRN was started, but can you tell me more about the wider collective view that came together to start it, and what the current state of McCaw populations are and the threats that they face?
Yeah, there's quite a few conservation organizations doing good work with parrots. And we just saw that there's a need for sort of bigger picture thinking, bigger work, and that's kind of where we're aiming to go to. And also a need to support conservationists in the work that they do across the region. So, and macaws are, then the parrots in general are in a mess. There's like 400 species of parrots, more or less, and about a third of those are endangered in some way. And with macaws, that's very much the case as well. The Sphinx macaw is almost extinct in the wild, although there's now, I think it hasn't been reclassified. There's three critically endangered species. There's another endangered species. I don't remember exactly the numbers. I'm not great at the details, but macaws are not in the best of shape. And so there's a need for work there. And rather than just working on a very localized level, I wanted to start looking at, okay, well, the great green macaw, which is our focal species at the moment, which is a critically endangered species, it's found across 6 countries. Let's look at ways to strengthen the work across all 6 countries. Our organization is only 5 years old, and so it is still early days for us, but that's ultimately where we want to go to. And that, I think there's a shift in conservation as well, where there was previously quite a lot of territoriality, and now there's much more openness to collaboration and need for it. There's recognition that there's a need to collaborate.
I myself have worked with a lot of NGOs, and I definitely experienced a lot of that territoriality, which I found quite shocking, because I thought, oh, why wouldn't you want to integrate and work together? But I've definitely seen a shift in the past couple of years as well, which is really nice to see, even from an outside perspective. You mentioned briefly there with your main focus on the Great Green Macaw, which I think there's something less than 1,000 left in the wild, correct? Over the six countries that they call home.
Yeah, the official measure is 1,000 adults.
Okay.
But it's still, like, there's not a whole lot of them.
Yeah. No, in the grand scale of things, they're one of the most critically endangered birds in the world, one of the rarest birds to come across. Can you explain to the everyday person what the importance of macaws as a species is in ecosystems, and why they should be worried about their current numbers?
Sure. Well, First and foremost, macaws bring colour and style to any ecosystem. I mean, they're just incredibly glamorous birds. And so that is something that's not a very biological answer. That's just a fun answer. But
no, it's 100%. I get that for sure.
From a conservation perspective, they have a really important role in that they can be a flagship species because they're very visible. Macaws are some of the most iconic of birds. I mean, you can think about penguins, flamingos, and eagles are kind of the birds which are kind of mainstream birds, and so we can use the macaws to benefit conservation for the whole ecosystem. So I, from my perspective, that's the kind of the, one of the most important things. But macaws have an ecological role, of course, and part of that is actually sort of the more evolutionary pressure that they put on ecosystems. So they're seed predators, and if we look at the great green macaw in particular, these birds eat this really, really hard nut that comes from a tree called the mountain almond tree. These are giant trees of 60 meters or 180 feet, and they tower above the canopy. They're incredible trees. But those trees have produced ever harder nuts because the hardest nuts the macaw can't crack, and then those nuts get to germinate. And so there's a selective pressure there, but at the same time, the macaw has evolved this ever bigger, stronger beak. And so that, if you take macaws out of an ecosystem, just as if you take any individual species out of an ecosystem, it has an impact on all the other species in this web. And so macaws have an important role there.
100%. Lovely said. Yeah, I think people forget about the knock-on effects that can easily happen by taking even any species that you may think is insignificant out of a food chain, out of a ecosystem, because you don't realize the cascade of ways that they can have an effect, like you mentioned with the trees, the germination, the wider roots of that as well, because of the effects that it has on other animal nesting areas, animal feeding areas. Very, very well said. I would love to know kind of how the NGO fully goes about to protect and conserve these magnificent birds. So for the listeners, I was very fortunate enough to spend a couple of days with the MRN earlier this year in Costa Rica, and I was working with the volunteer team on the ground. We did a lot of the nest monitoring up in the mountain almond trees, checking in on the macaw chicks, which was just one aspect of the coverage that I came across while I was there. So Sammy, I definitely love for you to touch on parts that I definitely didn't get to experience, but I also know that you guys are still doing further incredible work within that space.
Yeah, so we work with birds, habitat, and people. And when we work with the birds, really working to bring them back from the very edge of extinction. The trend is very clear. If we don't do anything, they are going extinct. But we can, from my earliest experiences in conservation, I've seen that hands-on management of birds can increase their numbers. So we're working with the wild population because that's the most important part of, you know, that's why we're here. So we're trying to understand why aren't there more macaws? And so there's really only two things you need to address. That's survival and productivity. So if your population is having lots of babies and all of those babies and all the adults are all surviving and living a long life, then your population is going to increase. But our population isn't increasing at the rate we would expect it to increase, given that the nest monitoring that you mentioned, that's been an important part of our work while we're working to understand the dynamics, what's happening. There's lots of babies, but the population isn't increasing. So that points to a survival problem, and we're trying to understand that. And that really sort of bothers me, because I've done research, I have a PhD, I don't want to do research. Research, to me, does not make a difference for parrots. Conservation is a very different thing, where we we execute actions which make things better for the parrots. And at the moment, we can't really do that in a well-organized, targeted way because we don't know the very key factor that's limiting the population. So we've got to do that research. We've got to understand what is happening. Is it that there's a food shortage because of selective logging? Is it that there's a disease concern? Is it that they're being hunted? And those are the things we need to understand, and then we can target that specific thing. So that's the situation with birds in the wild, but there is some work we can do to bolster the population, and that's captive breeding and reintroduction. So we've got a captive flock of great green macaws that are not suitable for release. They've been confiscated because it's illegal to have a pet macaw, or they were injured and they've been recovered. So we have this group of birds, they're having babies, and it's those chicks that we can release into the wild in unused forest, or forest that's unused by the wild population, but is you know, good forest. So we can build a population, a reserve population over here with those birds, and ultimately one day, hopefully, they'll all meet and then that will increase the population size overall. What would not make sense right now is to release birds in the wild population when we don't know what the full problems are that they're facing. So that's the work of the birds, but there's no point working with the birds unless they've got somewhere to go. So we've got to work with habitat as well. So we work with protection and restoration of habitat. We're actually in the process of, you know, buying and securing rainforest, and we've made a reserve. We've now got over 500 hectares of rainforest, and I want to see that grow. I'm aiming for a national park-sized protected area in the north of Costa Rica. But we're not going to do that all by owning it. We're going to do that through partnerships and collaboration, coming back to the collaboration. And, you know, there are other landowners that have this desire to protect the forest as well. Let's work together where we share values. Let's do that. And then the land that we're buying often has got pasture as well, because it was a farm. And so we're restoring those areas and putting forest back. And so that's the restoration area. But we're working with the habitat so that there's somewhere for the birds to live. There's no point working with habitat unless you're looking even further out and looking at the community and the population of people. Because if they're not behind the initiative, then, you know, when we disappear, then it's all going to fall apart. So we've got to get the community involved, and we've got to find value for the community from having a forest and from having, a good population of parrots. And that's not an easy task. That's definitely a challenge that we're puzzling through at the moment.
You've touched upon some great points there. We're going to take our first break to hear from our station sponsor, and we'll be back soon.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
The cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise. Elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Our Altered World. I'm here with Sam from the MRN. So, Sam, you just took us through an amazing detailed exploit of everything that kind of MRN are working on with the variations that are involved in conservation. You mentioned right at the start of that the trends that you guys are looking at for the core populations. I'd love for you to let me know how that has reflected over the past 5 years of the NGO's establishment to what you've seen in terms of those trends, what those trends are, what does that mean to the everyday person listening here, like, and what data do you get from that that you then try to implement changes from?
Yeah, so it's very early days. I mean, 5 years is a blink of an eye, really, on the grand scheme of things. We didn't mess everything up in 5 years, and we're not going to fix it in 5 years. So the trends, it's going to take a lot longer. And I mean, I look actually back at the Mauritius kestrel example, where I first was involved, where it took them 20 years to really get a rapid population recovery. And they're working out what the issues were to start with. So it's very early to say, you know, that we're seeing trends during the life of our organization. But I mean, we know that there's been a dramatic habitat loss since the sort of the 1950s. And initially that was driven by the North America's fast food industry and the desire for meat. So those are trends that are longstanding and pretty well established. We're not at a scale yet where we're able to reverse that, those things. I mean, taking on the North American fast food industry would be quite a challenge. But we're starting small. I mean, we're still ambitious within that. But I mean, ultimately, we want to get our mission is the Americas, and I would like to be contributing to conservation across the Americas, and that would be great. But in terms of actual trends, it's kind of, I think it's a little early to say that we've seen anything. We have established a population of scarlet macaws where they were extinct for 70 years. So that's something that's more of a success than a trend. But these are things we're monitoring, and like population data, the challenge is there's quite some inaccuracy if you're just trying to count the number of wild macaws. And so it takes a lot of years, a lot of data, if you're doing it every year, to sort of smooth out the inaccuracy and to see the trend there. And I think it's maybe a little early, infrastructure.
That might be the case on the macaw front, but I think you may be being slightly humble for the amazing work that you guys have done with the Sarafuki Rainforest Reserve, which was such a fantastic experience for me to go and visit. And I think this really leads in well to my next question with how community engagement initiatives have like contributed to the success of the MRN's conservation efforts. I'd love for you to tell us a bit about the establishment of the reserve, what led to that, how it has continued to progress, maybe link in some of the stuff about the Woodman Rangers. I think people would love to hear about that too.
Yeah. As I alluded earlier, from my perspective, the director of the organization, it's actually the other way around, where we need the community in order to achieve success, because our mission is the conservation of parrots. But you'd be most short-sighted if you tried to do that without the community engagement. So that timeline piece plays, you know, birds, then habitat, then people plays an important role. But it's actually it's necessary in the big picture, where we're trying to safeguard species. But then again, it's that thing of stepping back and looking at 20, 50 years, even 100 years. Like, you know, if all we do now disappears in 100 years, then it's a waste of time. So we've got to look at this big picture. So it's very strategic to involve the community and to do this reserve work that we're doing, because it's strategic in the short term, because it's a great way of engaging our supporters in our work. The people that are in this community have not had the opportunities that we've had to travel around and to go and do conservation, which is in a way is sort of a bit of a luxury. And so we've trained this group of women so that they can be rangers, and now we've hired them to do to lead our restoration work on.
Yeah, I think the work with the women rangers in particular was very empowering. I remember speaking to them at the plant nursery, and the work within MRN and the knowledge that they were gaining was not only benefiting them, but the wider community because of the education factor. They were able to help people feel more of like stewards of their own land, which I really loved hearing about.
Yeah, and this is very early in sort of the grand plan of where we want to go, because I mentioned earlier I want to create a national park sized protected area through collaborations and whatnot, and my goal is that becomes a community asset, so the local community can benefit economically from the protection of rainforest. So that comes through ecotourism and development of artisanal products that we can sell to tourists. Costa Rica leads the way on ecotourism. There's so much potential there. And then you've also got these new things like carbon credits and biodiversity credits. Well, this rainforest is just overflowing in biodiversity. And so it's just a matter of using our resources and our network to find ways to bring value to the community. So the community is a critical component of the conservation of the ecosystem and the planet.
Very well said. You've kind of interlinked into my next question, which I'm actually really excited about, because you've mentioned some of the opportunities there that you have touched upon with regarding ecotourism and how that can connect to conservation and how you can benefit from that. But what do you feel are also some of the key challenges, as well as those opportunities that you mentioned? And how do you feel like you guys can overcome these, and what help do you need there?
It's really straightforward. It's money. And I know it sounds mercenary to say it, but it's not that conservationists around the world don't know what they need to do. And it's just a matter of having the resources to do the work. And that's sort of this perception that nonprofits are like the little brother of the for-profit, but it's not that. It's just a whole lot harder to make money in a nonprofit and to get the money you need. But the model in which we work, it means that nonprofits are relatively struggling for resources. But if you extract from the planet, you can make loads of money, and then you can have more money to do more extraction. But it's really hard to monetize the restoration of the mess we've made. So this is maybe not the answer you're expecting, but for me, in my perspective, it's really a matter of resources. If we had enough resources, we could tackle the problems we have. And I mean, even it is really just a matter of resources changing behavior around consumption of beef in North America. There have been these huge behavior change initiatives that have worked. I mean, the way that we view smoking these days is completely different to when I was a teenager. Dropping litter, there have been these big campaigns. So we could do this. The knowledge of how to do it and what we need to do is there. It's just the resources to do it.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there with regarding knowledge. Something that I kind of wanted to bring it back to was the amount of pineapple exploitation going on in Costa Rica at the moment, which was shocking to me. And again, it was the knowledge factor. I had no idea this was going on. And being around that environment physically, you could see it in the atmosphere. It was heavy to breathe. And I was just thinking, what is going on here? And you would think, oh, okay, they're planting to help. Let's say that they're planting greenery. It's not cattle farming. They're not cutting stuff down and just having cattle feed everywhere. They're planting pineapples. It should be good. But it's not, because they're actually modifying so much biodiversity in the area negatively. I would love for you to talk about how this has affected the communities and the MRN, and exactly what's going on with the pineapple industry in Costa Rica, because I don't think a lot of people are covering this.
Yeah, well, there's, I think about very rough numbers, actually, I haven't looked at the latest data, but about 50% of the pineapples produced in Costa Rica go to North America, and most of the rest goes to Europe. It's astonishing to me when I'm in North America or Europe, how little a pineapple costs. But the production of the pineapples is a monoculture, and it's very intensive in terms of the agrochemicals required. And so there's a full load of pollution going on there, but it requires clearing the rainforest. I mean, legally that's not allowed, but there's a stepwise process where you make a cattle farm, or you clear a cattle farm, and then it becomes a pineapple area. And that the expansion of pineapple has been very dramatic. So the impact of it is really huge. And I think going back to stats, last time I looked, it was something like 85% of pineapples in the United States came from Costa Rica. And so there's a really clear connection there. But I mean, my concern with this stuff is victimizing, there's some reason to want to change things around pineapple, but everything you look at with the way that we're doing big food, there's problems with everything we're doing. So yeah, it's a challenge. It's that the scale at which it's happened in the great green macaw habitat is what's concerning for us. And I think it does impact communities. I think people that are working in the fields of pineapples are not exactly living great existences. There's all sorts of human rights things going on as well. I am not the expert on that stuff, but I definitely have concerns, and it's very shocking to see it when you can be surrounded by an incredible rainforest that towers above you, and then you emerge from the rainforest and it's basically a desert of pineapple. Yeah, it's pretty rough.
It was definitely, I would kind of say, a visceral experience seeing the actual imagery of it in real life. The contrast between the beautiful canopies of the trees, and then you just turn your head and it's just vast rows and rows of pineapple. But again, it would be something that it's so far removed from my existence, from most people's existence, most of the listeners' existences, that they wouldn't really know what's going on when they would go into a supermarket just to buy a pineapple, which you mentioned the pricing at much lower fee than what local Costa Ricans would be paying. Going back to the macaws, despite all these challenges, what gives you hope for the future of macaws and their habitat? Walk us through some of the successes that the MRN has experienced, or what you hope to experience.
Yeah, so the first part of that is, I think there's hope because I think macaws, being iconic, being big and loud, they're captivating. They're easy to see for local communities, and they're captivating. And the iconic piece feeds into the worldwide support for conservation. And there is a growing awareness of this, which is good for conservation. So I think there is hope there, and listeners are at the forefront of this, which is really great. And it's like there's a rising tide of concern for biodiversity. Macaws can be this flagship species where, when we save macaws, we're benefiting all the little creeper crawlies and all the other animals that are there that are maybe not quite as attractive as a macaw is. So I think the macaws are a good, a really good species for this flagship task. And then in terms of our successes, we've restored the population of scarlet macaws where they were extinct. And I think that's a big one. I think we're on the cusp of doing similar things with grey green macaws, with this sort of establishing a new population. And then I think over the past few years, we've been really learning a lot. I'll just go through a couple of hit lists. We've secured the rainforest. We've built a reserve. We've built capacity for restoration. The women rangers have over 100 different species of plants in the nursery. They have, I think, over 6,000 individual trees. And that capacity is getting bigger all the time as we grow with the restoration work. And then just having the Wind Rangers involved and our presence, the presence of the Macaw Recovery Network team in the north of Costa Rica has been really well received, and the team are really well respected by the community. So those are all great successes. I actually don't think those are that significant on the grand scheme of things, but I think we've built an incredible foundation. And I think let's look at, we're thinking at the moment, I've been in Costa Rica, involved with the conservation work for 10 years. The next 10 years, with the foundation we've built, we're going to go so much bigger and have so much more impact for parrots. And I think that's the biggest success is actually sort of behind the scenes, in that we've built this incredible team. We've got incredibly dedicated, hardworking professionals. The vast majority of which are Costa Rican. They're incredible individuals, and they are sort of primed to do conservation work and hopefully take it to a scale which is going to have a big impact for parrots. But give us, you know, another 10 years, another 20 years, then I think it's going to be really, I'm hopeful that we're going to have a good impact.
Fantastic. And on that note, we'll be right back after this short break.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movement and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Our Altered World. I'm here with Sam from the MRN. So Sam, you went through some amazing things in this, the last part of the show. I kind of want to know what you think and how you think seeing these beautiful birds in the wild can impact visitors or people's understanding of nature and their connection to the environment. Right at the start of our conversation, you mentioned your connection with parrots from being a young child. How do you think that can translate to those that are visiting places like Costa Rica or around the world where it is conservation focused or regarding parrot species or a variety of other species? And how do you think that will affect their connection with the environment?
Yeah, I think this flagship species thing where if you see macaws flying past, even now, if I see scarlet macaws flying past, you just have to stop them in awe. I mean, they're just awesome in the truest meaning of the word. It's like, I think you have to have a pretty cold heart if you're not inspired in some way when you see these magnificent, brightly colored birds flying past. And so I think that is this really valuable asset for conservation where in Punta Islita, we've got a tour visitor attraction where people can come and have a close encounter with a bird. They will see, not like feeding the birds or anything like that, but they get to see wild birds that we've reintroduced and they can see them up close. And when you have that experience, I think you get the connection and you then, it inspires people to want to conserve the birds. And it's similar to like, it's much easier to imagine going on safari in Africa and seeing lions or elephants. But it's that same thing when you can, if there's a species that's, tangible and you can have that connection. I think that leads to caring and the desire to not want to see these species go extinct in your lifetime, that kind of thing. So I think that is a really great thing about macaws.
So as climate, environmentalism, conservation is really at the forefront of a lot of the global topics at the moment, a lot of people are finding or wanting to find ways to integrate it into their own lives. It's kind of one of the purposes behind this radio show as well. You've mentioned the word ecotourism and how that plays in Costa Rica and how you kind of see it into the conservation efforts that you guys have. Can you kind of explain that on a wider scale of how you really see that working and where do you want people to actually be spending their money so that it benefits conservation, but also that they can have good experiences and benefit both the planet and themselves effectively?
Sure. That ecotourism has so much potential for helping conservation, and I encourage people to get out to places and see wildlife, because it's that connection as well. We'll come to the specifics of ecotourism, but maybe not so specific, but we'll talk about ecotourism. But then,
no, for free, you can go into the specifics of ecotourism. There may be someone out here who doesn't really know what we're talking about and would love to hear more about it.
But I think also just on a more personal level, going and seeing wildlife impacts people, and it's that there's some quote like a mind expanded by travel will never shrink again or whatever it is. But it's like,
you like that though. That is nice. That is well said. Whoever said it well.
Badly paraphrased, but if you see these species in the wild, then I'm sure it's going to have impacts on you as an individual. But ecotourism itself can really benefit the places where the wildlife is found. So I encourage people to do that. My sort of suggestions would be, of course, stay somewhere where you're going to have a nice experience, but get out of the big hotel or the lodge and put some money into the local community. Find ways to support local entrepreneurs if they're trying to sell some art. Even if you don't want the art, give it to somebody for Christmas. But spend your money where the local community, because it comes back to that thing of bringing value from protecting an ecosystem. And also, I'd say, tell everybody that you're there because of the parrots or because of whatever animal it is, so that they know there's this connection. And it's not just that they're coming to see your country, that you're going to see their country. It's that you're going because of this animal. I want to see albatross. Or I want to see penguins, actually. The people when I travel to that place, they're not necessarily going to know that was my motivation. Convey that. I think that's an important thing. And then just, support the little guys as well as the big guys. I mean, the hotel owners are, great. What great efforts they've done to create this ecotourism opportunity. But let's spread it around a little bit so it goes a little further. Don't eat every meal in the hotel. Go out to a local restaurant. Those kinds of things. So that would be my suggestions.
Do you think of this sort of comparison between the fact that Costa Rica, global biodiversity hotspot, hundreds if not thousands of various of flora and fauna species, people go to Africa, Kenya, South Africa, Tanzania for wildlife safaris, and they go specifically to see these various and beautiful animals in these amazing landscapes. Costa Rica obviously may not have the same sort of spatial availability to have those sort of tours, but do you think there's ways that they can alter the way that they kind of advertise that sort of experience to really connect those guests who are seeking wildlife-based experiences in countries like Costa Rica, comparatively to what I just mentioned with those that take place in Africa?
There's different, competing with elephants is impossible. I mean, I've seen elephants in the wild and it's amazing.
You might not be targeting the same person. There might be someone who's deeply passionate about elephants, and there could be someone who's deeply, deeply passionate about sloths or deeply passionate about macaws, and they really want to see them way more than elephants. You know, there's 8 billion people on Earth, mate.
Exactly. So you've got to find the thing that you can do better, or that's the unique selling point. I think there's a great opportunity in Costa Rica for quiet-based tourism. In our environment these days, we very rarely have moments of experience where we don't have a noise that from a human-made thing. So you can go, I've just been somewhere where lots of hype about it, but I found it to be an extremely noisy place. There's road traffic noise wherever I went in this natural environment, and it really detracted from my experience. I think this is kind of a new thing that not everybody's aware, at least for me, a sort of new realization. But I think peace or natural quiet is a commodity that we could market in the north of Costa Rica. So it's a bit like there are now holidays where you can go get offline and you can get away from it all. And I think doing that in nature is a great thing. So I think there are opportunities there. Seeing macaws, well, you're not going to see those in Africa. So yeah, you're going to have to come to the Americas, and Costa Rica's really well set up for macaws. But there's a whole ton of other species. There's tapir that you can see, big cats and things like that. So there's unique things, and there's a whole different experience. The culture is different, the food is different. But Costa Rica is a relatively, compared to some other countries, it's very safe to visit, as well-established tourism, and so it's got a lot. It offers a lot.
What are the most surprising things that you've learned about macaws during your research?
I'd say like there's this idea that macaws pair for life, and well, I think it's very similar to human terms. And if one of the pair dies, the other one will probably repair. But just the fact that they spend 24/7 in the company of another parrot, I think we became aware of our own human need for social interaction through the pandemic, when everybody was shut away in their apartment buildings, and everybody was kind of like going mad. Well, it's not a surprise when captive parrots do the same, and you know, we see that if they're on their own,
are they just flying in circles?
Yeah, so I think, you know, having that, just seeing how they're hardwired to be in a pair, that's really something. And then sort of a growing awareness of culture, which is the knowledge that's passed on from one generation to the other. It's not in their genes, it's learned behaviors, and just the significance of that. And I think we're really on the cusp of that. So we think of, I'm going to go elephants again, you know, in periods of drought, the matriarch elephant will lead the others to water holes that she knows, because she has this big mental map of the environment in which they live. Well, macaws are moving around the environment in a similar way. They're not just flying around willy-nilly. They're going to trees that they know produce fruit at that time of year, and the chicks are learning, you know, the fledglings stay with the parents for 9 months or more, and then they hang out in juvenile cohorts. So they're learning from each other, and just, I wouldn't say that we know all the things there, but I think that's a fascinating area of study that we've cracking open. I think that's amazing.
What are the long-term goals for your organization, for macaw conservation, and how do you envision the future of macaws in Costa Rica?
Well, when Columbus arrived in the Caribbean, I understand that he said or wrote that there were so many parrots, they darken the skies. And also at that time, I think that the men on the boat complained that there's so many, you know, they couldn't sleep because of all the sea turtles hitting the hull of the boat. And we have this problem of shifting baselines. My vision is that, you know, parrots are a common sight in their ranges where they're found. Like that they were, that, you know, when we see large flocks of birds, and wouldn't it be magnificent to see large flocks of macaws on a regular basis? That would be incredible. And if that's achieved through the Americas, that would just be phenomenal. I think if we can get to a place where the average person realizes the value of that for them and their sense of well-being, I think that would be incredible.
What a beautiful vision and painting that you just gave me in my creative mind. I was like, wow, this looks stunning. More for this. I guess, yeah, like off the back of that, what sort of legacy do you think you would like to leave for future generations? I know you kind of mentioned the fact that you guys are 5 years into the MRN and kind of where you want to see yourself in 10 years. But where does, let's say, the youth generation now, like the really young kids, let's say 6, 7, all the way back, about to 13 years old, you know, just like in that stage where they're really learning about the actual state of the world and what they can do with it. What do you want to do for that generation that are coming into sort of like teenagehood and adulthood?
I think the thing there is actually culture again, but not for parrots, but for people this time. I think the ultimate legacy is to leave a cultural impact where nature is valued and protected. That is a huge challenge. But I think, you know, any single achievement, sort of tangible achievement, like protecting a certain amount of forest or anything, that's relatively short-lived. And I think if we can change, in a really, from my perspective, a really positive way, change culture so that nature is valued, I think that would make my life a whole lot easier. You know, or the future conservationists, their life would be a whole lot easier if everybody recognized the value of nature and conservation.
Well, I kind of would love to hand over the microphone, metaphorically, to yourself, to kind of just tell listeners what they can do to help protect the macaws and other wildlife, and where they can find out more about you guys, the MRA.
Well, for sure, the ecotourism piece is something I would, if anyone's thinking about going to see some wildlife, go and do it. And that doesn't need to involve international travel. In Britain, I've never seen a capercaillie, and I'd love to, you know, if I ever spend time in Britain, I'd love to do that. But those kinds of things, just get out and see nature and contribute to that. Beyond that, I'm of the mind where I actually... I'm not a big advocate for individual action on don't eat pineapple, or I just don't think that the impact of that is going to have a significant benefit for macaws in our lifetimes. Donate. That's the thing. Donate. It doesn't have to be to the Macaw Recovery Network. Of course, it'd be wonderful if you did, but donate where you feel a connection with an organization, you think they're doing good work, and you want to impact that species, because that's going to be really at the point of the needle where it's going to have impact. I really encourage people to do that. You can find out about Macaw Recovery Network on our website, macawrecoverynetwork.org. We're all over social, same handle, Macaw Recovery Network. And please connect with us, and we look forward to chatting to you there.
Right, well, thank you for that. To our listeners, I will make sure that all the information that Sam has mentioned is linked to this particular episode on the UK Health Radio website. And I would like to thank everyone for listening to Our Altered World today. If you enjoyed the show, I'd love for you to visit our website, ouralteredworld.com, where you can join our community and find out more information on upcoming shows. You can also find some of my work on social media at FlunkingMonkey, FlunkingMonkey. And thank you again, Sam, again, for joining us today. And thank you all. Until next time, I hope you have a great day.